I'm David Tennant, and this is How Roald Dahl Shaped Pop.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, the chocolate room.
Roald Dahl was the first children's author to achieve pop star status in Britain. During the 1980s, he became a regular on kids' TV, where he got as fanatical a reception as the bands he appeared alongside.
Depeche Mode will be in the store all morning, call them. And James and the Giant Peach author, Roald Dahl, will be here to tell us about his latest book, Revolting Rhyme.
It was a decade in which he scored hit after hit, The Witches, Matilda, and the BFG, to name but a few. These weren't your typical children's stories. They were anarchic, outrageous, and subversive. Some would say, just like rock and roll.
The good thing about Roald Dahl is the fact that, you know, not everything's nice.
He never tamed his imagination, and I think that's rebellion in itself.
There didn't seem to be any boundaries. There was nothing that was taboo.
He really wrote in the spirit of rock and roll, actually.
What a rock star.
But Dahl is more than just a kindred spirit. He's an influence too. 20 years after his death, this is a new tale of the unexpected. The stamp he's left on the world of pop.
Hold your breath. Make a wish. Count to three. Come with me, and you'll be in a world of pure imagination. Take a look, and you'll see into your imagination.
Come with me to hear the music and musicians inspired by Roald Dahl. Those whose songwriting has been influenced by his storytelling style.
Songs like Same Size Feet and our first record were probably a nod to him. Definitely songs like Stop to Fill My Car Up.
Little Red off my first record was Roald Dahl inspired.
There was specific reference in a song called If You're Feeling Sinister to a Mike TV in the Chocolate Factory.
Those whose creative juices have been stirred by his vivid, fantastical tales.
What struck me was the magic. And the feeling of wanting to conjure magic is something that's really stuck with me.
And those who've turned his stories into song for films and musicals. One of those tracks, An Ode to Willy Wonka, even gave a Rat Packer his only US number one. Come with me to hear How Roald Dahl Shaped Pop.
When Roald Dahl's got you in his grip, there's nothing quite like it.
Everybody ready? Come on then, here we go. Roald Dahl's children's books tend to have a recipe which makes them utterly delicious to kids. First off, there's a conceit that is totally outlandish. Say, a giant magical peach full of talking insects. Then, there's a good dollop of rudeness and a sprinkle of gobble-funk, Dahl's invented language. Words such as whiz-poppers and snozwangers are guaranteed to get a giggle. But usually, the most important ingredient of all is that the child is the hero of the tale. Often they're poor, orphaned, misunderstood or badly treated, which only makes their victories taste even sweeter.
I feel very strongly about children who are in sad or desperate situations, but I think more importantly from a writer's point of view is that it's a classic and unalterable fact that the more you can start a child off in a rotten situation, the more wonderful it is when he becomes a hero or finds a treasure or anything, you know.
Dahl has a particular dislike for violent, vindictive adults, born out of his experiences as a child. He never forgot the brutal canings dished out by his school teachers. However, his own childhood also taught him the joy of something that crops up again and again in his books. Revenge. At the age of 7, Roald and his friends decided to get their own back on the vile and loathsome owner of their local sweet shop in Cardiff. Fed up of the way Mrs. Pratchett treated them, they took a dead mouse into her store. When she wasn't looking, they dropped it into a jar of gobstoppers and waited. George exacts a similar revenge on his selfish, cantankerous grandmother in Kate Nash's favourite Roald Dahl story, George's Marvellous Medicine.
The old hag opened her small wrinkled mouth, showing disgusting pale brown teeth. "Here we go," George cried out. "Swallow it down." He pushed the spoon well into her mouth and tipped the mixture down her throat. Then he stepped back to watch the result. It was worth watching. Grandma yelled, "Owee!" and her whole body shot up, whoosh, into the air. It was exactly as though someone had pushed an electric wire through the underneath of her chair and switched on the current. Up she went like a jack in a box, and she didn't come down. She stayed there, suspended in midair, about 2 feet up, still in a sitting position, but rigid now, frozen, quivering, the eyes bulging, the hair standing straight up on end. George's Marvelous Medicine was one of my favourite Roald Dahl stories. I love that book. It's just the words of, like, everything that he's putting in the potion and, like, I don't know, you just feel like you're almost eating it as well. You feel like you can taste everything that he's writing about. The shaving soap, the hair remover, the dandruff cure, the automatic washing machine powder, the flea powder for dogs, the shoe polish, the black pepper, the horseradish sauce, and all the rest of them. It's really great to have books like that to read, to stir it up inside of you and make you want to, like, come up with these crazy ideas. The way I like to write stories and invent characters, I think that's come from Roald Dahl, really. And I think a lot of my songs are about just telling stories. When you're a kid, sometimes you can feel a little bit insignificant and you feel like you're never taken seriously. And in Roald Dahl books, like, the kids always like the main role and they're always really smart and important as well. That really inspired one of the songs on my first record called Mariella, about a girl who decides that she doesn't want to speak to anyone anymore because she just doesn't really feel like she fits in and she wants to be more mysterious. She feels like a little bit of a lost soul even though she's only seven, and she, like, prit sticks her lips together. She, like, glues her lips together. Sometimes I wish I was like Mariella. She got some prit stick and she glued her lips together. That's a really sick, dark thing to do, like, glue your lips together. I think that's what I like about Roald Dahl. His stuff as well was really sick and twisted. People used to say she's as quiet as a mouse. She just doesn't make a peep. She marched to her wardrobe and she threw away the collar, because wearing black looks mysterious, but it didn't impress her mother. Her mum's like, please, you have to have your friends around, and, like, I want you to wear all these, like, pretty pink and flowers and colours, and she's like, I'm only going to wear black from now on. And, like, her teachers are like, oh, she's only going through a phase, it'll pass. But she knows that even though everyone's underestimating her because she's a kid, she knows how serious she is about it, and she's so determined that she's never going to ever unglue her lips from being together, because she doesn't need anyone and she can think with herself and she can play with herself. At school, Mariella didn't have many friends. Yeah, the girls, they all looked at her and they thought she was quite strange. She said, I'm never ever 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 ever. Yeah, I'm never ever 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 ever. Gonna unglue my lips from beating together. Ha 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 ha. I think his stories can really stir my mind as well. It makes me want to come up with little places and stuff that don't really exist and invent characters that do really weird things that are kind of surreal and almost magical in a way. I kind of think that Little Red as well, which is off my first record, was kind of Roald Dahl inspired. It's about, like, an invented town and this character Little Red.
Made a little town out of stones and out of wood, and they a little king out of plasticine.
If there's a feel of Dahl to Little Red, it's because the song takes you to an eerie other world, a fantastical town overseen by a king made of plasticine. Dahl tends to pluck his characters out of reality, whisking them and you to a place of wonder and fantasy.
You do take the child out of their own life in the very beginning, you must do, and start them off in a world that they haven't quite ever seen. If you start them off in their own cosy living room and dad and mum sitting around and all that, it's no good.
When Roald Dahl's got you in his grip, there's nothing quite like it.
Alex James of Blur.
It sort of carries you away. It does feel like we're just being taken off at breakneck speed into these strange worlds of his imagining.
Just take the BFG. The giant snatches Sophie from her bedroom window, grasps her in his hand, and gallops through thick forests and rushing rivers to a great yellow wasteland where trees stand dead like skeletons. In this desolate place lies a hidden cave, the BFG's home, which is jam-packed with jars full of good dreams. Natasha Khan, better known as Bat for Lashes, takes you to Dahl-esque worlds of awe and mystery in many of her songs.
God woken in the night by mystic golden light, my head soaked in river water.
I'd read George's Madness Medicine at night time with a torch under my duvet, and I just remember being so excited about this giant cauldron of crazy medicine he was making, and so began months of experimentation in the bathroom. And I would pour different thicknesses of shampoo and different colours of toothpaste into Tic Tac boxes and make these bizarre horror pieces. Roald Dahl, he seemed like a grandfather I always wanted, that could tell me these really amazing stories that felt relevant. And I remember reading The Witches and just looking, every time I went out or to go to the sweet shop or anything, me and my friends would look for women with gloves on and see if we could guess whether they had real hair or not. And I think what struck me was the magic and the feeling of wanting to conjure magic and to tell stories and to weave a world of illusion and imagination and dreams is something that's really stuck with me.
Horse and I.
We can all understand the need to escape, feeling lonely or rejected or dreaming of some better place that you can go to. I identify with a lot of his stories because I feel like home was quite a sad place sometimes, and I think for a lot of people growing up can be full of difficulties and feelings of isolation. And to dive into books like me under my duvet with my torch in the Witches or whatever, it creates like a home, a place where you feel understood. And I feel like my way of doing it is to tell stories with journeys in them, to use symbolism and characters and landscapes and magical faraway places, because as a child I was obsessed with magical faraway places. Creating my first album was a very kind of new and exciting experience, and it was very much rooted in childhood and telling stories. And having sort of been through the promotional rigmarole for the last 5 years, I feel like I was coming to a point where I was starting to forget those magical places and kind of shutting down and being tired and not letting my imagination run free. And just today, sitting on the train and reading James and the Giant Peach again, I felt really inspired, because I just look at him and I think he was much older than I am, and he retained that spirit of childhood and freedom. And so I think he's influencing me perhaps now more than he ever did. It's really good to have him back.
Although Dahl achieved greatest success in the 80s when Natasha Khan was growing up, his biggest hit was actually published in Britain many years previously, 1967 to be exact. And if ever a book was of its time, it was Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Picture yourself in a boat on a river with tangerine trees and marmalade skies.
1967 was the summer of love. The charts were awash with psychedelic pop songs, and the Chocolate Factory read like one of them. Both the Beatles and Roald Dahl took us on river trips through bizarre but delicious worlds. A steamy mist was rising up now from the great warm chocolate river. And out of the mist, there appeared suddenly a most fantastic pink boat. And then, "This is my private yacht," cried Mr. Wonka, beaming with pleasure. "I made her by hollowing out an enormous boiled sweet. Isn't she beautiful? See how she comes cutting through the river?" The gleaming pink boiled sweet boat glided up to the riverbank. 100 Oompa Loompas rested on their oars and stared up at the visitors. What made, and continues to make, the book so irresistible to kids is its central storyline. It's simply every child's fantasy. Charlie Bucket starts out with nothing. His family are so poor they're starving. Yet he ends up with the ultimate prize. Willy Wonka hands him the chocolate factory itself. He has as many everlasting gobstoppers, rainbow drops and luminous lollies as he could ever desire. Blur's Alex James was enthralled by it.
I was about 9 when I found Charlie and the Chocolate Factory in the classroom library, and I read it because of the title. And as soon as I finished reading it, I started reading it again and again and again. I got quite obsessive about it. And when I discovered there was another one called Charlie and the Great Glass Elevator, God, I still remember that sort of feeling of my heart leaping, like that there was more to this world. I still think that's his most perfect work. It's about the most perfect thing anyone's ever done. It's up there with Sergeant Pepper and Tomato Ketchup.
Stuart Murdoch of Belle and Sebastian felt similarly.
The very best one was Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, no question. As a kid, first 60 pages were my favourite things ever written down, just because of the possibilities of this person who had nothing, suddenly having everything, being this one human picked out for glory. And of course you always rooted for him and hoped it would be you, and you knew what was going to happen every time you read those 60 pages, but the pleasure was no less. And then after that it went into the factory, and that was a great adventure, just the whole magic of discovery. There was one specific reference in our songs from a song called If You're Feeling Sinister. The character is a very sad character, is going through all sorts of ponderings about religion and the meaning of life and whether it's all worth it. The last verse he or she decides to cheer up and decides to rent a television and a video and fantasizes about being on television and how that would surely make life worthwhile for some reason. And so she imagines that she's in a million pieces, which is a direct, not so much steal, but a reference to Mike TV in the Chocolate Factory.
Like the character in Stuart's song, Mike TV is obsessed with television. His mind begins to race when he witnesses Willy Wonka's enormous camera turn a giant chocolate bar into a million pieces, which are then sent to a TV screen. And what about people? Asked Mike TV. Could you send a real live person from one place to another in the same way? A person? Cried Mr. Wonka. Are you off your rocker? But could it be done? Good heavens, child, I really don't know. I suppose it could. Yes, I'm pretty sure it could. Of course it could. I wouldn't like to risk it, though. It might have some very nasty results. But Mike TV was already off and running. The moment he heard Mr. Wonka saying, I'm pretty sure it could, of course it could, he turned away and started running as fast as he could towards the other end of the room where the great camera was standing. Look at me, he shouted as he ran. I'm going to be the first person in the world to be sent by television. No, 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 cried Mr. Wonka. Mike, screamed Mrs. TV, stop, come back. You'll be turned into a million tiny pieces. Here's If You're Feeling Sinister.
All right, I'll give it a go. When she got back, her spirituality was thrown into confusion. So she got a special deal on renting from the man at Rediffusion. Look at me, I'm on TV. It makes up for the shortcomings of being poor. Now I'm in a million pieces picked up for deliberation by the people listening at home, by the people watching on the telly, by the people listening at home, by the people watching on the telly. But if you are feeling sinister, go off and see a minister. He'll try in vain to take away the pain of being a hopeless unbeliever. I think when I was writing something like that, you don't think, okay, now I'm going to stick in a dull reference. Certain authors fall by the wayside. Certain things that you were that you loved when you were young fall by the wayside. But the best ones have gone in deep and are festering around there and do come out. And any comparisons with Dahl will be gladly taken.
The shock rocker Marilyn Manson is another artist who cites the writing of Roald Dahl as an influence, particularly this story. In fact, his debut album, Portrait of an American Family, begins with him belting out lines of verse from the Chocolate Factory.
Yes! The danger must be rowing! Follow!
In the book, they're sung by Willy Wonka as his boiled sweet boat enters the pitch black of a tunnel. Marilyn Manson says in his eyes, Wonka is Satan because he presents people with the temptation of picking good or evil. It's certainly a dark interpretation, but then again, much of Dahl's work is sinister and macabre, never more so than in his adult fiction. Although he's best known for his children's novels, Dahl began his career writing for grown-ups. During the 1950s, while living in New York with his first wife Patricia Neal, he produced a wealth of short stories that won him great acclaim. Their style and content is neatly summed up by the poet and Dahl fan, Laura Dockrill.
Murder, usually. Sex, usually. He loves to spin everything on its head. He loves the women to kill the men and the animals to eat the people. And you sort of find yourself being suckered into this complex universe. Then it just unravels before your very eyes and it's just like, da, da, da.
I never really did his children's books when I was growing up, but I always remember the short stories and the Tales of the Unexpected being on ITV when I was a kid and staying up later than I should have been with that woman dancing in the flame.
Kelly Jones from the Stereophonics.
I always loved the one where there was a story about a boy going to the bed and breakfast and he went wandering around the house in the middle of the night and then he ended up finding this room with all animals stuffed and things like that, and then I think it cuts to the end of the story and then he's stuffed at a school desk or something like that. So it's just like pretty extreme storytelling, you know what I mean?
That thrilling, spine-tingling style of storytelling has influenced Kelly's own.
Storytelling was always something I was fascinated by in music, and we always had a book of Roald Dahl in the studio. I always loved Dahl's writing for that kind of underlying element of oddness. The Bartender and the Thief is a bit like the thief, the cook, the concubine, all that kind of stuff, but also, you know, just very odd kind of surreal lyrics. Robbing graves of the bodies dismembered and stuff like that. And so I did use those kind of, you know, painting pictures kind of thing in music, which is always what I like to do anyway, you know, very descriptive, very image-based. I loved stories like Lamb to the Slaughter, where she kills him with a lamb chop and then feeds it to the police who come around to investigate the murder, which I think is just such an amazing twist in a story. And I think songs like Stop to Fill My Car Up on Performance and Cocktails were probably a nod to him, which is about a guy getting in the back of your car in a petrol station. A man round 40 in the backseat must have stepped in when I was empty. Asking you to drive on and you don't know why he's there and he's got a bag of money. Curiosity's a woman. Step down from the car. He pulled a gun from his jacket. Said I was going to die. The last twist in that song is that I just made the whole thing up just to get somebody's attention for the 3.5 minutes of the song. Well, I just made up this story. To get your attention makes me smile. I think it's the unravel, really, which I loved. It's always like he sets something up which seems very, very normal, and then bit by bit it just turns into this thing where you just never expect it to go. I always found it very unpredictable. But you get kind of hooked in on it.
I'm David Tennant, and you're listening to How Roald Dahl Shaped Pop on BBC Radio 2. That last line of Kelly's, "I just made up this story to get your attention makes me smile," is truly a sentiment worthy of Roald Dahl. He possessed what has been described as a flagrant disregard for the truth. He certainly never let it get in the way of entertaining. Even some of his autobiographical accounts are embellished. Take Shot Down Over Libya, the first piece of work Dahl ever had published back in 1942. An account of his wartime experiences with the RAF, it suggested he'd been in a plane taken out by enemy fire. In fact, he had run out of fuel and crash-landed. According to his friend and biographer Donald Sturrock, Dahl didn't feel bound by anything as conventional as the truth. He was a rule-breaker, a rebel, a provocateur.
I think he was completely rock and roll as a person. He was anti-establishment. He, in the end, didn't give two hoots what people thought of him. If you went to dinner with him, there was no subject which was off limits to talk about, you know, how much you earned, who you were having sex with, all these things that certainly at his time, English people didn't normally ask each other over dinner. In terms of seeing himself as this outsider who looked in on the establishment, on the way things were, he was very, very rock and roll.
His passion for pushing the boundaries and breaking the rules is evident in almost everything he wrote. Alex James has always found this artistic bravery inspiring.
I think it's just his stance in life that's inspirational. It's really, really hard to be the first person to do something. And his stories are just so out there. I think when you read him, you sort of know that you're in the command of somebody saying exactly what he thinks. And really, that's what you've got to do to sort of communicate anything, whether it's art or music or writing. He really wrote in the spirit of rock and roll, actually. He broke rules and you sort of cheered him on.
Rock and roll means to me just being free of constraints, letting your imagination or your spirit or your beliefs be free and expressive and creative.
Natasha Khan again.
I really sense the freedom in his words, and I think that there didn't seem to be any boundaries. There was nothing that was taboo. I think that he was definitely rock and roll, yeah.
But like many a rock star, Roald Dahl eventually shunned the bright lights of the city for a home in the English countryside, Gypsy House, in the Buckinghamshire village of Great Missenden. It was here, inside the brick writing hut at the edge of his orchard, that he came up with many of his greatest stories.
I think a love of the English countryside was perhaps the most underestimated quality in his own personality. I mean, he chose to come back from New York, where he'd had this terrific success during the war and just after the war, and elected to live in the English countryside. He loved the seasons. He loved being in amongst the trees, sitting in them, looking out at nature. I think in books like Danny Champion of the World, he really lets that lyrical side of him loose in a way that isn't let loose in some of the other stories.
The book tells the story of Danny and his dad, who live in an old gypsy caravan, just like the one Roald Dahl bought, restored, and kept in his own garden. They fly kites on the hills, listen out for crickets, and go for walks on which they see skylarks and weasels. Dahl's love of the countryside jumps off every page. A familiar concept crops up too. "I would like," he whispered, "to find a way of poaching so many pheasants from Hazel's Wood that there wouldn't be any left for the big opening day shoot on October the 1st. "Dad!" I cried. "No! Shh!" he said. "Listen, if only I could find a way of knocking off a couple of hundred birds all in one go, then Mr. Hazel's party would be the biggest washout in history." 200? I said. "That's impossible." "Just imagine, Danny," he went on, "what a triumph, what a glorious victory that would be. All the dukes and lords and famous men would arrive in their big cars." And Mr. Hazel would strut about like a peacock, welcoming them and saying things like, "Plenty of birds out there for you this year, Lord Thistlethwaite," and, "Ah, my dear Sir Godfrey, this is a great season for pheasants, a very great season indeed." And then out they would all go with their guns under their arms, and they would take up their position surrounding the famous wood. And inside the wood, a whole army of hired beaters would start shouting and yelling and bashing away at the undergrowth to drive the pheasants out of the wood towards the waiting guns. And lo and behold, there wouldn't be a single pheasant to be found anywhere. And Mr. Victor Hazel's face would be redder than a boiled beetroot. Now, wouldn't that be the most fantastic, marvellous thing if we could pull it off, Danny? Songwriter Danny Wilson has always loved the romance and rebellion of the story, so much so, he named his band after it.
You can't buy love of the truest kind.
I'm Danny from Danny and the Champions of the World. You know, I'm called Danny, and the book Danny, the Champion of the World, my mum read it to me kind of continually until I could read it myself, and it just felt like the perfect name for the band, not because it's a pun or everyone knows it, which it works on that level, you know, but because in a way the band was all about kind of flying by the seat of your pants and not being a conventional band or trying to do things the conventional way. So it was very much about sleeping in vans and going out, and we recorded the albums, both albums, on a farm in Oxfordshire, and very much about sort of doing this whole Danny and his dad thing, but in a band. The caravan was our house and our home. It was a real old gypsy caravan with big wheels and fine patterns painted all over it in yellow and blue and red. My father said it was at least 150 years old. Many gypsy children, he said, had been born in it and had grown up within its wooden walls. With a horse to pull it, the old caravan must have wandered for thousands of miles along the roads and lanes of England. But now its wanderings were over, and because the wooden spokes in the wheels were beginning to rot, my father had propped it up underneath with bricks. I wish I lived there. There's a similarity there between this passage and Henry the Van.
Henry the Van died at the roadside on the road to Aberdeen.
Henry the Van is a song that opens our latest record, and it's a song, an ode for our camper van, you know, that we toured in, but also me and my kids and my wife, like, went on holiday in. And it was the minute you sat in it, even if you're going down Asda, you know, this, the freedom was kind of in the air. You could absolutely sort of feel yourself like the possibilities were there, even though you're just going somewhere rubbish, you know. But we did really amazing romantic things in the band, you know, touring and stuff, and the song's very, very true. It's very literal. We were driving it up in one of the first Champs tours, and we were in between Dundee and Aberdeen, and the van kind of started spewing out all the stuff you don't want to see. Like in the song, it says, "Your water's in your oil," you know, which is really sad. It's a really sad song about a camper van, I guess. But the truth is that the song really is about, you know, is the dream over? And I guess ultimately the answer is absolutely not, and never will be, you know. But it's very romantic, and it's completely Roald Dahl inspired.
You were built for better things. Romance of the road and the poacher sings.
The book Danny the Champion of the World, it was such a huge inspiration to me as a kid and continuing to now.
Well, take me back to Tourmalet, man, back in the day. Weren't we just the keepers of the dream, Henry? Is this the end of the road?
The 90s rock band Veruca Salt also owe their name to Roald Dahl. Veruca is the spoiled, obnoxious girl who, like Charlie, wins a trip to Willy Wonka's chocolate factory, but ends up being thrown down a rubbish chute by 100 squirrels. It's an utterly outlandish turn of events, but these vivid madcap passages are exactly the sort to get Gabriella Chilmi's creative juices flowing.
Ooh, watching me, hanging by a string this time.
A lot when I was writing my first record, I'd kind of read books that would take me to another place, and then just scribble down whatever came into my head, and then go into the studio and sing those lyrics down in whatever melody I could find.
Don't easily, a smile worth 100 lives.
Roald Dahl was one of the authors that I'd read. I just really like the way he kind of makes you like a young kid again and gets you in touch with your inner child, and you can imagine all different kinds of things. You just open up your mind.
Sweet about me.
There's a lovely parallel here, because as a young man, Roald Dahl used music in a similar fashion.
In the old days, before I was married, I never used to start writing in the morning before putting on some very great music, like a Beethoven quartet, and sit and listen to it in the hopes that some of this greatness would rub off on me, and that I would write better. As a matter of fact, it helped quite a lot, because it is impossible, after listening to great music, to write absolute rubbish.
But what sort of music did Dahl enjoy? We got a clue just then, but perhaps his taste in music is best summed up by this statement found in his private notes. Beethoven is a genius, pop singers are horrible. Although pop might love Roald Dahl, the feeling wasn't reciprocated. There was no place on the record shelves of Gypsy House for the Stones or the Sex Pistols, even though Dahl was a kindred provocative spirit. Instead, his collection was largely made up of the works of the great composers. In 1979, he shared his favourites when he appeared on the BBC's Desert Island Discs.
I would choose masses of Beethoven if I could, because he's one of the great men, him and Bach. This is a fine record, and played by a fine violinist, Yehudi Menuhin. I once said to a professional musician in Washington called Mark Bitstein, what is the greatest musical work that's ever been composed? And he said, Bach's Mass in B minor. And I went home and I played it, and I must say, I think he's right.
His friend Donald Sturrock says music was a passion, comfort and inspiration to Dahl.
All through the late 1980s, when I used to go over to Gypsy House and have lunch with him or have dinner, usually when you arrived at Gypsy House, there was music blaring out of the sitting room, often at quite high volume. Usually Beethoven, Mozart, Brahms, something, but very, very often Beethoven. Well, Dahl once said about writing that one of the reasons he was so passionate about getting kids to enjoy reading was that in times of crisis, of sadness, depression, illness, reading provided a kind of lifeline, an alternative world to live in, which took you somewhere other than where you were at that time. And I think music did exactly the same for him. It took him to an alternative place where his realm of fantasy that was so important to him could be indulged in some way. I think that's why the big romantic classics appealed to him so much.
His tastes did stretch a little further than the great composers, though.
When he was really unhappy at school, his letters home often show that he took incredible consolation in listening to music. He had his own gramophone record player, and he asked his mother to send him records, and he started at a very early age to know what he wanted to hear. He was quite eclectic. He was very keen on Paul Robeson.
Tied to my rocking chair all day, till the day is over.
And he liked the Rodgers and Hart, Rodgers and Hammerstein, Irving Berlin, Gershwin-type musicals. He became quite a good chum of Hoagy Carmichael during the war.
In my heart it will remain my stardust melody, the memory of love's refrain.
Although, from his letters, it seems that although he celebrates the fact that he wrote Stardust, he was spent rather more time singing rude RAF songs around the piano with him.
It should come as little surprise to learn that Dahl loved performing these risque songs. They were filthy, outrageous, and brimming with black humour, just like his writing. While they're poems rather than songs, Dahl's revolting rhymes are similarly dark and naughty, and they beg to be performed out loud.
Little Red Riding Hood and the Wolf. As soon as Wolf began to feel that he would like a decent meal, he went and knocked on Grandma's door. When Grandma opened it, she saw the sharp white teeth, the horrid grin, and Wolfie said, "May I come in?" Poor Grandmama was terrified. "He's going to eat me up," she cried, and she was absolutely right. He ate her up in one big bite, but Grandmama was small and tough, and Wolfie wailed, "That's not enough. I haven't yet begun to feel that I have had a decent meal." He ran around the kitchen yelping, "I've got to have a second helping," then added with a frightful leer, "I'm therefore going to wait right here till little Miss Red Riding Hood comes home from walking in the wood."
Laura Dockrell, performance poet.
Dahl always cheats, which is great. Like, even the "she saw" dragged onto the last line, it's like, he went and knocked on Grandma's door. When Grandma opened it, she saw the sharp white. It's like, I don't care. Because it's made to be read, I think. It's just so inventive and innovative. And it's in a whole league of its own to be able to just see language as malleable as clay that you can just sort of play with. The rule breaking is very exciting for any artist. I just think it's heaven on earth.
Comedian and self-proclaimed rock superstar Tim Minchin was captivated by these vulgar verses as a child.
Your love is like fingernails on a chalkboard.
More than the books, it's revolting rhymes. That joy of being stupid with words, of pushing rhymes, of finding the naughtiness in rhymes and stuff, is what my whole career is built on.
The dark humour so evident in Tim's music brought him to the attention of the Royal Shakespeare Company when they began searching for someone who could write songs for a new musical version of Dahl's Matilda. He's loved adopting the arch tone of Dahl.
He sees childhood and reflects it in such a tangible way, and yet he's not writing like a child. Matilda starts with him going, "Most parents think their children are amazing, but when they're actually little spoilt little bastards," you know, it's really rude. And that my whole musical starts with a whole lot of fat kids going, "My mummy says I'm a miracle. One look at my face and it's plain to see. Ever since the day Doc chopped the umbilical cord, it's been clear there's no peer for a miracle like me." Like that. And it's like the whole thing is like these horrible kids talking about how brilliant they are. And that's what's been so great for me, is because you get to have a little bit of judgment. You get to impose an adult's slightly cynical eye on this world, because Dahl does it himself.
But some of the story's characters lend themselves to song easier than others.
"Your mummy's a twit," the trunchbull bellowed. She pointed a finger the size of a salami at the child's head and shouted, "You look like a rat with a tail coming out of its head." "My mummy thinks I look lovely, Miss Trunchbull," Amanda stuttered, shaking like a blancmange. "I don't give a tinker's toot what your mummy thinks," the Trunchbull yelled, and with that she lunged forward and grabbed hold of Amanda's pigtails in her right fist and lifted the girl clear off the ground. Then she started swinging her round and round her head faster and faster as Amanda was screaming blue murder and the Trunchbull was yelling, "I'll give you pigtails, you little rat." Getting Trunchbull to sing, you know, finding, you know, this kind of Trunchbullness is easy. It's in her name, it's in her build, it's in Quentin Blake's drawings. It's all put on a platter for you. And Mr. Wormwood sort of, you know, he's so cheesy. And Mrs. Wormwood sings this song that goes, "You gotta be loud, loud, loud." Like, it's just brash, and the choices make themselves. But the story is of Miss Honey and Matilda finding each other, these little eyes in the storm. They are quiet, peaceful people in a cacophony of a world. And then trying to get them to sing is really hard because they're not demonstrative. Trying to find Matilda, this balance between her being brave and a little bit cheeky and doing all these tricks and stuff, and that she does magic, she ends up doing telekinesis. And one of my briefs was to try and sing a song about that moment where she feels so angry that the power comes out her eyes. What is that feeling? And it took months to figure out what it was. And so the song now is called Quiet, and it's about this massive build. And hopefully it's going to be the sort of most important musical moment in the piece, where this kid's describing this build up and the music's building and building and building, and then it just goes into this light. Like really quiet. It's going to be a tiny kid singing this song about how she gets this sense of peace out of being teleconnected.
Once again, Tim has found inspiration in Dahl's poetry.
I reference revolting rhymes in Matilda. The kids sing a song called Revolting Children that goes, We are revolting children living in revolting times. We'll sing revolting songs using revolting rhymes. We'll be revolting children till our revolting's done, and we'll have the trunk. Anyway, not give too much away, but I loved getting the term revolting rhymes into it, because the challenge of turning one of Roald's non-poetic texts into songs and trying to find where the songs might be in that, you have to turn to his poetry to remind yourself of the sense of anarchy and just fun that's in it.
There are clues not just in his poetry, but in the lyrics littered throughout Roald Dahl's books.
There are very few of his books, actually, that don't contain songs, particularly the children's books. And I think he was longing for those songs to be set in the rambunctious tone that they were usually written.
Since his death, that wish has been realised. In 1996, the singer-songwriter Randy Newman was asked to write the soundtrack for a new film adaptation of James and the Giant Peach. He took a set of lyrics found within the book and set them to music for this boisterous track.
Mosquitoes on a piece of buttered toast, and pickled spines of porcupines, and then a great big roast, and dragon's flesh, quite old, not fresh, it costs a bucket most.
Does it come with gravy?
It comes to you in barrels if you order it by post.
Now this is where the relationship between pop music and Roald Dahl becomes even more inextricable. Eating the Peach is a song directly based on his work, rather than one inspired by his storytelling style, yet once again, its writer is a rock musician. Those adapting Dahl's stories for the big screen often seem to seek out pop's most caustic and eccentric writers to deliver the soundtrack. As much as Dahl may have hated pop music, it seems film directors feel those with pop or rock sensibilities are best suited to translate the humour and chaos of his writing into music. Be they Randy Newman, whose songs such as Short People share something of Dahl's sarcasm.
They got the baby leg, they stand so low, you got to pick them up just to say hello.
Or Danny Elfman, who wrote the soundtrack to the last Charlie and the Chocolate Factory film. He spent years in a new wave band called Oingo Boingo, who were as bonkers as Willy Wonka.
And I don't care what people say.
Wes Anderson turned to a similarly offbeat but very English pop star when he wanted to inject a Dahl-esque quality into a song he'd part-written for his adaptation of Fantastic Mr. Fox.
About a handsome little fox, let me sing you folks a yarn. Hey, diddle-dee, daddle-da, doddle-do, doodle-dum.
Jarvis Cocker.
When he asked me to write Petey's song, it was an unusual situation for me, because normally I'm known for being a lyric writer, I suppose. But in that case, he'd already written the lyrics to that song, and he just asked me to write some music to it. And he'd kind of written this kind of zoopy guy, goopy guy, goopy guy, goopy guy. It kind of sounded like a kind of hoedown type of number. And I kind of thought maybe he's picked me because I'm the least appropriate person to write a kind of bluegrass hoedown type song ever, being considered quite an English songwriter, I suppose. But I think that probably worked to its favour, you know, because I think although Roald Dahl wasn't English by birth, he lived most of his life here, and his stories are recognisably set within the English countryside, you know, and so maybe getting that kind of a hoedown by way of being filtered through an English sensibility in the end was quite appropriate.
Arguably, the most famous film adaptation of Dahl's work is Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. Released in 1971, Dahl had what could politely be described as an indifferent relationship with the film.
I thought the film was lousy. Although I wrote the original screenplay, I wrote it just like the book. Unfortunately, it was Hollywood. And Hollywood are not very good at adapting books. You would think if they'd had a book which had been really very successful for many years, that they would say, we better not tamper with it and screw it up.
Nevertheless, the movie has proved endearingly popular, in no small part due to its score, written by Grammy Award winners Anthony Newley and Leslie Bricus. It even delivered a bona fide chart hit.
I had not read Charlie and the Chocolate Factory until David Walper, who produced the film, thrust it under my nose. He called me one morning and said, I want to talk to you about something. And Newley and I went over to his house. We said yes to the assignment immediately. We wrote the whole thing very quickly. It wasn't difficult at all because he gave you such richness to draw from. I could have written 25 songs for that score because there were so many moments that you could musicalize. I mean, the Golden Ticket screams to be a song, has to be a song.
I never dreamed that I would climb over the moon in ecstasy, but nevertheless it's there that I'm shortly about to be. Because I've got a golden ticket.
And the Oompa Loompas have to have a song.
Oompa Loompa, doompa-dee-da. If you're not greedy, you will go far. You will live in happiness too. Like the Oompa Loompa, doompa-dee-da.
Obviously, there had to be a song about Willy Wonka, and Willy Wonka's not a very good title for a song. And I think it was Tony's idea to call him the Candyman. The Candyman was the worst song of all in the score in terms of what it was like on the screen because they gave it to an actor who could not sing.
Who can take a sunrise, sprinkle it with dew, cover it in chocolate and a miracle or two? The Candyman. The Candyman can.
And when we saw the film, we were so horrified. It was the only time you ever saw that actor in the role of the man in the sweet shop. And Newley offered to redo it himself for nothing, just so that he could do the song properly. But they'd shot it in Germany and the cast had been dispersed, so you didn't have the opportunity to do that.
The Candyman can.
Sammy Davis had been recording everything we wrote in that era, and we were just lucky that, miraculously, he did a recording of The Candyman with a young producer called Mike Kerb.
Candyman, hey, Candyman.
Yet, somewhat reluctantly, according to his agent, Cy Marsh.
He said, are you kidding? Me sing Candyman? I'm going from bad to worse, you know? He said, all right, let's get it done. We go into the studio, and Sammy looks at the lyrics and says, oh, boy. And after Sammy did one take, Mike Kerb said, I like it very much, but I need one more take. And Sammy looked at me and said, well, we'll sell two. You're going to buy one, and I'm going to buy one.
You can even eat the dishes.
But Sammy had misjudged the American record-buying public. They loved it.
Sammy used to call me every 3 days and say, it's number eight, it's number five, it's number two, because it was, he'd never had a number one record, and it was something that completely came out of the blue. It was a complete freak success. The last thing anybody in the world thought was that it was a number one record.
The Candyman can, because he mixes it with love and makes the world taste good.
So in a story so bizarre that Roald Dahl could have written it himself, the legendary Rat Packer scored his only American number one, not with a song about love or living it up in Vegas, but Willy Wonka.
Hold your breath, make a wish, count to three.
Come with me and you'll be in a world of pure imagination.
Despite its huge chart success, The Candyman isn't Leslie Bricus's favourite song from the film. That honour falls to Pure Imagination, a track that's subsequently been covered by a variety of pop artists, from Johnny Mathis to Maroon 5.
Come with me and you'll be in a world of pure imagination. Take a look and you'll see into your imagination.
that's my favorite song in the film score, because the character of Willy Wonka is about using your imagination, and that appealed to me because it was a nice thing to say to children, for children to think that if you use your imagination, you will live in a much better world than if you don't. I'm sure that Willy Wonka reflected what Roald Dahl himself was like. He had such a vivid and wide-ranging imagination, Roald Dahl, that he was so full of ideas. All his stories are full of the most brilliant, exploitable ideas, that it's a goldmine for writers and musicians.
Even if Roald Dahl believed pop singers to be horrible, he'd surely have been proud that his imagination had fed theirs, that they too had delighted their audience with the oddest of characters, the most fantastical of journeys, and stories full of suspense.
He's a master storyteller, up there with the greats.
He helped me to feel enthusiastic about storytelling.
I think he's terrific. He just had that natural storytelling gift.
I would have loved to have known him. I bet he was just such a fun, cool guy.
But those stories, if you've had them read to you as a kid, they stay with you.
Monstrous, gritty, gross tales that will just sort of swerve your childlike imagination to the darkest corners.
They were inspired not just by a children's author, but by an unwitting rock star. Rebellious, provocative and outrageous, Dahl truly wrote in the spirit of rock and roll.
There is no life I know to compare with your imagination. Living there you'll be free if you truly wish to.
That was How Roald Dahl Shaped Pop, presented by David Tennant and produced by Chris Walsh-Heron. This is BBC Radio 2, online, on digital and on 88 to 91 FM.